Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. Well, I've been talking about cryptozoology. Isn't that a wonderful word to fill your mouth with? Well, if you want to start a conversation at a party, toss that one out, and people are going to look at you, probably with their fork stopping in midair, wondering, who is this person, or what is this person talking about? Well, that's what the show is going to be about today. We're going to be talking about some unique characters. My guest is Dina West Budd, and this is the Wiser Field Guide to Cryptozoology, and we're going to find out all about what that special word represents. Hi, Dina. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Donna. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, you're a woman that is just someone that follows my heart in so many ways because you love the unique. You love the paranormal. In fact, you're an editor for Bella Online, and you host a Monday morning radio show on KHBL 96.9 out of Hannibal, Missouri. And you just absolutely love the weird, the unusual, the phenomenal, the fantastic, the unbelievable. Let's see, what other words could we come up with?
We're going to be talking about all of those.
Oh, all of that and then some, huh? Werewolves, dragons, skyfish, lizard men. And all kinds of fun things. This is the perfect show for the Friday. I just think it's just a great way to end up a week. Now, I want to know how a nice girl like you got involved with all of these weird characters.
Well, you know, I've been interested in the paranormal since I was a kid. I guess it started with Dark Shadows. I don't know if you remember Barnabas Collins and Angelique, and I would rush home from school every day to watch that show. I think that might be how it all started.
Ah, so the seeds were planted, and we blame television for this.
You know, and then I got interested, of course, in Ouija boards and seances, and I just, the older I got, the more my interest varied in the paranormal, and here I am.
And here you are. Okay, let's talk about the word cryptozoology. Where did it come from? What does it mean? And what does it represent?
Well, it actually means the study of creatures not proven to exist by science. And it was created by the master of cryptozoology, Bernard Hubelmans. And this was in 1959 that he coined the phrase cryptozoology. It can include a lot of, there's a lot of discrepancy on exactly what the term it can include. Many cryptozoologists believe that it's just the hairy humanoids like Momo and Bigfoot. Other cryptozoologists include giant creatures and aliens, the New Jersey Devil. Some even include mystical creatures, fairies and dragons, and werewolves and zombies.
It's fascinating stuff. Now, how long did it take you to put together this information? Because you have covered quite a few various creatures.
Well, they gave me 5 months. So I worked up until the very last night. I had to overnight it. Yes, it was something. I really had no idea. This is my first book, and they contacted me. The publisher contacted me through my website on Bella and asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book on rods. Skyfish, the flying snakes, and there's not enough information about those creatures. So then they said, well, how about a book on cryptozoology? So I just started researching and studying, and then it finally all came together.
Well, we've all known about flying squirrels, and of course there's gazillions of insects, but there are creatures. I mean, look at bats. There's been all kinds of species that have been on this planet. Let's talk a little bit about the rods, the skyfish.
Okay.
Where, you know, you have something happening in November 1996 in Mexico. So tell us what happened there.
Well, actually, a film was made in 1996, and Jose Escamillo, he's the founder of these rods. He's the one that first discovered them on film in 1994 while he was filming a documentary in New Mexico. And then he noticed on a film in 1996, a film about base jumping in the Cave of Swallows in Mexico, he noticed that there were rods on this film. And so he went there in 1999 and recorded a colony of these creatures just flying everywhere. They're too fast to be detected by the naked eye. Sometimes you might catch a glimpse of them out of the corner of your eye, but they're mostly noticed on film. I believe in the movie Braveheart, there's one right behind Mel Gibson's shoulder. And that's how they are seen is on film.
Well, now, with this, and because of our technology, were there many legends relating to this prior to it being seen on a film?
There's a possibility that, well, for instance, in Japan, they have some old drawings of these creatures, and it's possible that's what they are. It hasn't really been determined that that's what these drawings are, but there's a company in Japan that has actually created traps for these creatures. They're called spoodles.
Spoodles, okay. Sounds like something out of Harry Potter. Spoodles. All right. So what are the spoodles supposed to do? They're supposed to catch them, but if they're that fast and they're able to move that quickly, how do they expect to catch them?
I haven't heard of any being captured yet, so I think it's just kind of a fun thing.
Well, I liked your question because at the end of the chapter on the skyfish, you wonder what are they eating? And there's all kinds of microscopic creatures in the air, and if they have been found to be in clusters, this is really interesting phenomena, because just when we think we have all of the knowledge about every living creature that's on this planet, we find, excuse me, that's not the case. We've got maybe a few hundred thousand that have not been even discovered. We haven't gone into places where we've discovered at all. It just is amazing the way nature works.
It
really is. You have something else in here which I found very fascinating, and it was the Mongolian death worms. Now, this sounds like something out of Dune, but people have, as in sci-fi, often conceptualize things, and then all of a sudden something like one of your books comes up, and you go, excuse me, let's check out the Gobi Desert. Maybe all we need is one of those ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom units, and, the worms will come up. So talk to us about these death worms.
Well, like you said, they're in the Gobi Desert, and I have terrible allergies. Okay, I'm sorry. They're in the Gobi Desert, and they actually spit toxins.
Yeah.
And I'm so sorry. I went and got a shot, but it's not taking effect as quickly as I would have liked it for it to take effect. I have seasonal allergies, and they just seem to get worse every year. But they are in the Gobi Desert, and they spit toxins. They range from 2 feet to 5 feet in length, I believe. They're kind of a blood red color, but they can change their color to match the environment. And they have spiked projections at both ends, so it's kind of hard to tell which is the head and which is the tail.
Well, that would make it really tough. Now, one of the, a couple of facts that you have about worms, and this is, they're not known to be dangerous in other countries, but there's one in Victoria, this is in Africa, and then there's also a New South Wales squirter earthworm that...
Uh-huh.
It squirts, but it's not toxic stuff. And then there's one in South Africa that they found in 1936 that measured 22 feet long.
Right, yeah.
I mean, that's enough to give anybody the willies. I mean, if it's 22 feet long, you think of a python. I mean, that worm has to be in diameter. Are they really big in diameter? Are they like pythons, but,
Well, they're about 2 feet in diameter, yeah.
Holy Moses.
They're big. They're huge.
Well, I wonder what they eat. Well, maybe I shouldn't ask.
I think that they eat a plant called the Saxall plant, and there's not too much known about that, but that's what is believed, that they eat this plant. But the scary thing is that this this toxin that they emit, it's this poison that corrodes everything it touches, even metal.
Amazing.
It spits this toxic substance, this acid-like substance. It spits it as a defense mechanism.
Fascinating. Now, we've all heard of Galloping Gertie, the wonderful creature, the water creature that people have had some photos of. You talk about water horses. And Galloping Gertie is not Galloping Gertie. My goodness, I'm using the wrong one. That's the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. That's what she was called. But the creatures that in many ways look like the brontosaurus, and they're found in different parts of the world. They think they descended from giant sloths. Am I correct?
That's one theory, yes. Yes.
Well,
you're talking about the bunyips, right? The bunyips, the water horses.
Yes, the bunyips. So tell
They're
us about the bunyips, because the Australians have a lot of legends about them.
They're fascinating creatures to me. I really love the water creatures a lot because I love water. I guess they're about the size of a small pony, kind of look a little bit like a sheepdog. A lot of accounts say they have black shaggy hair, some say white. They've been described with wings and fins, flippers, claws, walrus tusks, alligator scales, feathers. There's another variety that's been sighted with a kind of a bulldog-like face, and then, of course, there's a variety with the long neck, and that's been reported only in the New South Wales area. But, they've been seen all over Ireland and Scotland. I've not heard of any, that they're harmful, that they're dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard much about that at all. You know, I don't know that they are dangerous.
Let's talk about the giant kangaroos, because you mentioned that there's legend about them being here in North America at some time in the past. But let's talk about these giant kangaroos. Now, they can be a pretty good size, but when you're talking about giant kangaroos in the United States, most people's eyebrows would go up. I mean, you've got reports here of being in Puyallup, Washington. That's our next door neighbor here from where we are. And there have been in Oklahoma, Colorado. How did you find
them? Illinois, those yeah.
Yeah, where
that is crazy to me. That is one of the craziest stories. there have been kangaroos all throughout the Midwest in the United States. That is a crazy story, but gosh, they're able to leap 20 to 40 feet in a single bound. Seeing a creature able to do that would be disconcerting. But they actually attacked a couple of police officers in Chicago in 1974. A kangaroo.
What?
Did. Yes.
1974. Police officers were attacked.
Yes, two police officers in Chicago were attacked by this creature.
And they think it was a kangaroo.
Yes.
Now, that amazes me because of the variances of weather. I mean, I thought they were warm weather creatures. Maybe it's just because I've just associated with Australia. But that is amazing.
It is.
Were they able to track them?
Were they able to what? I'm sorry.
Track them.
No. Now, they were spotted several more times in the Chicago area after the attack over the next couple of months. But then the creature disappeared without a trace.
Amazing. That is absolutely amazing. Who would think in the United States we had big kangaroos? Now, how big were these kangaroos?
Well, I guess 5 to 6 feet is the standard size that in my research that I found. They were 5 to 6 feet tall.
Now, when doing your research, were you doing this on the web? How were you getting your information?
All ways that I could find. I lots and lots of books, lots of research at the library, a lot on the web. There's so much on the web nowadays.
That's
amazing.
Truth. Well, here
and I had to sort through and try to, you know, I had to sort through. There's so much that I had to verify. I couldn't just include it in the book if I just came across one account. You know, I had to verify it with several sources. I didn't want to just have anything in the book.
Well, that's true. Here in the Puget Sound area, we have waters that are home to some of the biggest octopus in the world. And I noticed that you brought out information about Luska and other giant octopus. And I made a note after reading it about the Jules Verne story, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, and the Nautilus and how the giant octopus came out. Well, they have found since then, and it's been so long since I've seen the movie, that I couldn't remember if it was a giant octopus or a giant squid that they used in the movie. But they're actually are giant squid of humongous size that they've been able to find. And there have been carcasses that have come up on coastlines, not very often, but they had a real tough time identifying it. What was your research? What did you discover regarding the giant octopus? Because I'm pretty sure they exist, but they're probably at extreme depths. Am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. And the story that you just told is true. They had a terrible time identifying it. Several people had to become involved in it. Samples were sent, but then I believe the samples decayed. The tissue was really very hard and difficult to cut. It was very difficult to identify. But the final they finally did decide that it was an octopus. I think you're talking about the boys there on in Andros Island, and the boys, they were bicycling, I believe, and saw this thing washed up on the beach.
Yes, and also, well, there's a few places. There was one measuring 20 feet by 18 feet found in western Tasmania.
Oh, and, yes, in 1960, yes.
Yes, and then there was another, they call them globsters, which I found very interesting. Then one in Australia. Now, that one was 8 feet long, and then there was another 8-foot carcass found in the Mangrove Bay of Bermuda, but they really are quite perplexed. Of course, we know so little about what's in the ocean. It's very, very difficult to do the research because there are depths where now, because of robotic equipment, they've been able to go down and find that there are forms of life where they had just assumed nothing could live at certain depths, and they're going, excuse us, that we were really wrong, because there's all kinds of life forms surviving down there. Even in scalding waters out of volcanic vents, there are all these life forms that are quite content, quite happy in their hot water environment. So there are the giant squid, you bring out about that, in Norway and Iceland, that have been known to grow to be 43 feet in length. Mm-hmm. Now, that means that those creatures, number one, have a very good food supply, and number two, they're older than 10 or 15 years. They have around a long time to be able to grow to that kind of a size.
I would think, yes.
Well, I know that I learned from Alaskan fishermen, this is many years ago, that your halibut, your king crab can live to be, you know, well over 50 years of age. Your king crab could possibly live to be 100 years of age. And
you're kidding.
Yes, and they're just, they are, your crabs are your scavengers, your halibut are bottom fish. And I didn't know this, but you can judge a fish's age by its cells and its scale structure, from what I was told. This was many years ago.
And that is so interesting.
Yes, so the halibut, all of these things, you don't realize that when you have creatures or animals of this size that are in the water, they have had to have a very good amount of food source available to them. It's not unlike the great white. I mean, if they survive and they're that big, I mean, how many predators are they going to have? When they're that kind of a size, they're quite old. They have been around for a long, long time. Now, let's talk for a little bit about the flying men. Now, throughout the history of mankind, of course, in the Middle Ages, they had all of these legends, and you had in the Greek history, you have the flying creatures and the man-animal creatures that are there. But you talk about one in Falls Hill, Nebraska. So you're going to have to educate us about Falls Hill, Nebraska.
Well, this is kind of crazy to me because this flying man actually had an apparatus attached to him via a shoulder harness. This was in 1956, and I guess there were all kinds of lights on this apparatus, and the apparatus was controlled by there were dials on this panel on the man's chest, and the man was very odd looking also because he was kind of old looking and he had kind of a devilish face. But a lot of the flying creatures don't necessarily have this apparatus attached to them. And I kind of doubt that they could be, you know, the same. The ones because there have been several with the apparatus, and I think that they might be, you know, that they're probably from a different source than the creatures without the apparatus, which might be angels or demons, possibly.
Well, I know. We always like to give them some connotation like that because it's just so cool. I mean, it adds so much to the story when you can classify them like that. But in Camp Okubu in Japan, there were soldiers that said they saw flying men that had wings with a wingspan of 7 feet, and the men, if they were standing, would also be about 7 feet. And that's intriguing to me. That was in the 50s that they saw them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And then there was something in Guadalupe, Mexico, police officers in January of 2004, and it was a woman with black hair dressed all in black. I bet you those guys were questioned, and they wanted to know if they had, you know, a little tequila with a worm in it, having reported this, because they said that this woman was entirely black and she had no eyelids.
Right, yes. Yes, and you know there was a naked winged woman seen in 1969 in Vietnam by 3 Marines, and she had huge bat-like wings, and her skin was black, and she kind of radiated a greenish light, and they could actually hear her wings flapping.
Oh boy, that must have made for an interesting story. We have so much that is out there that when we don't understand it, I sometimes wonder how much the imagination brings into it. But sometimes that which is real is really real. You look at some of the illustrations that were done by people in Europe that would hear about different creatures, and they tried to draw hippopotamuses, and they'd never seen them. And,
right. Oh, yes.
You know, giraffes and all kinds of stuff. And you look at them, and you go, excuse me, but you got the tail in the wrong place, or I'm sorry, the head isn't there. This is what they look like. And it's difficult sometimes to describe things when
it is.
You actually
it is.
See them.
Right. And, you know, when I try to when I see something and I if I don't have a piece of paper with me, trying to retain everything, to write it all down is very difficult. And sometimes 3 people can see the same creature, and there's certain things that stick out to each person differently, and they could describe something totally different, yet they're all seeing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. You have some wonderful, wonderful stories in here. I think this would be absolutely fascinating to any kid that really wanted to, you know, to tell tales and say, hey, but I'm quoting it from the book. This is what I've got. I mean, this would be so much fun for young people. But I think even for conversation, to talk with people, say, what do you think about this? And, of course, most people say, ah, that's a bunch of hooey. Yet there are so many recordings of various creatures that can't be explained away. It's very, very tough when you are stuck in a certain paradigm of thought. When you were doing this research, what kind of amazing things really, really grabbed you that you said, wow, I wish I could see this because I've got this research here?
Well, the thing that struck me the most about when I was writing this book was the fact that so many of the eyewitnesses were credible people. So many were police officers and town officials and teachers and people like that. That's what struck me because I was so surprised by that. But I think the creatures that probably interest me the most would be the skyfish, the rods. I just love them. I also think that the Kentucky goblins I think that was a very scary story. I can't even imagine what I would do if these creatures would attack my house like that. I just,
okay.
I can't even imagine.
You got to tell us about the goblins. It's not Halloween, but you got to tell us.
Well, this was in the Kelly and Hopkinsville region of Kentucky, and in 1955, in August, at a rural farmhouse, the Sutton family were visiting with some guests that were from Pennsylvania, and they noticed something in the sky, an odd light, kind of flames of all different colors, and it seemed like it descended into a ravine a few yards from the house. Well, a little bit later on, they started seeing these creatures coming from the direction of where they thought these lights had landed. And these creatures appeared to be about 3 or 4 feet tall. Their skin was metallic looking. They were humanoid, very slender, thin appendages. They had claws, a long slit for a mouth. They were kind of glowing, and their eyes were also glowing. Well, they didn't really hurt these families, but they started kind of tormenting them. They kept coming to the house and just kind of crawling all over the house and kind of scaring them, you know, looking through the windows and just scaring the family. Well, the men in the family went out and started shooting at these creatures. And the women, they asked their husbands to stop because the creatures hadn't been hurting anyone and the children were getting really frightened. So then they all piled in their cars and they went to the police station. And this is all on record. And the police chief, he realized that there was something going on because these people were scared to death about something. And they went back out to the house. They saw all the bullet holes from where these guys had been shooting at these creatures. They saw some weird lights in the woods that didn't have any apparent source. They saw kind of a greenish tinge on the fence where one of the goblins had been shot. They didn't get a sample, unfortunately. But nothing else was going on. So then the investigators left, the media left. And it happened again. These creatures all came back again and started tormenting this family. Eventually, they moved out of the area because they got so much ridicule about everything that had happened. But I believe that it really did. I believe that it happened. I don't know why these families would want to, change their whole life, have to move to a different area, just to make up a story. I can't imagine that. I really do believe it happened.
Well, for those of you that love spooky stuff, this is a book, Cryptozoology, really good stuff. And there's the giant spiders in here. And I'll have to tell you, I had a personal experience with a giant spider. I was about 17, 18 years old, and I had just gotten my first apartment. This was in Los Angeles, California. Uh-huh. And I had cleaned out. This was just a little tiny place that I was in. But it was mine, and so I was cleaning and washing the floor, and I had to empty out the bucket filled with the wash water. And so I go outside, dump the water out because there was a big vacant lot behind me. I turn around, and here is this spider that would have filled a salad plate that was right on the door that I was supposed to go back in. I'm telling you, I've never seen anything so big in my life, and I don't remember the colors now, but I froze. I mean, I totally froze, and I thought, oh, my goodness, what am I going to do? Well, I must have stood outside that door for a good hour, and I just was frozen to the spot. I had never seen anything of that size. Fortunately, it had moved just enough where I could open the door, and I had visions, if I opened the door and went inside, that thing would jump into the room. I was just paralyzed with fear, and what happened was, I managed to get brave enough. I thought, this is ridiculous. Look how much bigger you are than this spider, whatever this was. And I managed to get the door open, rushed in quickly, closed the door because I thought, oh, I just can't stand this. A few hours later, I went and I said, I got to find out if it's still there. It was totally gone. And I asked someone about it, and they talked about a particular species of a spider. And they said it probably came from the vacant lot. You'll never see it again. And for some reason, it was there. But they say they do get to be quite large. And you've got this article in here about giant arachnids. Well, I'll tell you, Dina, it makes for a great Friday show. All of these wonderful stories of the Lobo Wolf Girl of Texas, the Lizard Man of Scape or South Carolina. I mean, you even have the Beast of Bladenboro, North Carolina. They're all over the country, folks. And if you want to know about them, you need to get the Wiser Field Guide to Cryptozoology. Great conversation. And it'd be a great project, too, for kids to do research on the Internet. Now, Dina, your website is bellaonline.com. That's B-E-L-L-A online.com. I want to thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me, Donna. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, it's been a wild and woolly interview, I'll tell you, in more ways than one. Everything from giant octopus to who knows what, flying humanoids. Cryptozoology, the Wiser Field Guide. Great gift for somebody that has everything. This you could give them and they would never forget it. BellaOnline.com is her website. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break and we'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, TTAP.com.
Hi, this is Donna, and telephone lines are now open, 888-815-9756, if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, 888-815-9756. Now, for those of you that have had your own particular paranormal experiences, I'd love to hear your story. I'm putting together a book. I'm collecting 100 stories from people from around the world, and yours might be included in the book as well. And if you will send it to me via email, whether it has been a precognitive dream, a particular situation about synchronistic coincidences, it could be about a ghost story, maybe having a member of your family come back in a dream and giving you information, all kinds of experiences. I'm putting it together because I think the more that we can be able to communicate about these experiences openly, the more it helps those people that are having experiences realize that it is not unusual to have unusual experiences. So send me an email, donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. And be sure to include in the subject line either Donna Sebo Show or the story for Donna's book, something like that where I can identify that you are sending me a story, and I'd love to hear from you again. Again, send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. Well, Mother's Day is day after tomorrow, and I wanted to share a couple of things with you. I came across this story, and I just think it's adorable. There was a little boy, he sat on the curb in front of his house one day, and his head, he was cradling in his hands, and he was sort of shaking his head back and forth, and one of his buddies came by and said, "Hey, you know, what's the matter with you? What are you worried about?" And the little boy said, "I've been doing some thinking. Dad slaves away at his job, so I'll have lots of toys and plenty of food and a nice house with a room all my own. He told me last night he's working hard so I can go to college someday if I want to." Well, his friend listened and said, "So what's the big deal? What's causing you to worry?" Well, the little boy, sitting on the curb, he just kept shaking his head. "Well, that's not all. My mom works hard every day. She's cooking, she does the laundry, and she takes me places, and when I get sick, she takes care of me." Well, his friend sat down by him on the curb, just looking at him as if he's nuts. He said, "I don't get this. What do you have to worry about? You got a great life. You got a great family." Well, his little friend looked at him and said, "Yeah, but I'm worried they might try to escape." Ah, yes, I think there are moments when many parents have that feeling. But I had to share that with you because I thought it was a cute story. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. And here's a poem by Olivia Austin. "A mother is a sunbeam when you need a little warmth, a stepping stone towards your destiny. The ladder that leads to your dreams. All the qualities you admire, honor, and look up to. A mother is life. Put this song." I think that's an exquisite poem by Olivia, and I'm so grateful that she was willing to share it. Well, I've got some interesting stories that I wanted to share with you, one about a UFO, but if you wanted to chat, 888-815-9756 is the number to call into. Also, I wanted to let you know about our guests that are coming up next week. Every moment matters. Being mindfully present is so important. John St. Augustine has written a book about this. He is a producer for the Oprah Winfrey radio show, so he's going to be with us on Monday. And then Peter Canavo's book, Pope Annalisa. This book is winning awards like you would not believe. I just got an email from Peter this morning, and he has gotten another nomination for an award. This book is a novel, and for those of you that are regular listeners, you know that I don't do novels very often, but this one is phenomenal, and I recommend it highly. It is so now. It is absolutely amazing. Then the Spirit Whisperer, Danielle McKinnon, is going to be my guest next Wednesday. We're going to be talking about animal communication, and I've had guests on before, and Danielle did an anthology with John Holland and a number of other people, so she's going to be with us. And then we're going to be talking about music on Thursday. The Figurados are going to be my guests. They've got a music piece, Divine Spirits, Holy Smoke. Well, they're into, you might say, a little bit of the rock and roll, but the lyrics to their music is really, really something. So we're going to be doing music next Thursday, and then a week from today, we're going to be talking about gypsy magic. Raymond Buckland is actually a gypsy, has put together a phenomenal book about gypsy lore, history, how the tarot cards came about, how the gypsies really do live, herbal remedies, all kinds of interesting things. So we've got a great lineup of guests next week, and I hope you'll tell your friends and also join us. Now, if at any time you want to find out more about the guests that are coming up on the Donna Sebo Show, just go in to BBS Radio, as you always do, just to hear the show, and then tap on the Donna Sebo Show, and there's a listing of the guests as they are scheduled. And, of course, you can always call in and chat with me at 888-815-9756. All I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then I'll give you insights into yourself and what's going on in your life. Science is moving forward. I was having a conversation with some people today, earlier, and we were discussing how technology is moving at such a pace that even the people that are involved in technology are hard-pressed to keep up with it. In fact, someone was telling me that a friend of theirs who is really involved in technology and the think tank process of what can be and making it happen, that this person got ill, was out of work for, about 3 months, comes back into the working environment, and he said he's never going to catch up because so much had gone on in that 3 months. We live in a time frame where the speed of change is just incredible. Well, it's got its positive sides. It's got its downsides, too. But in the area of medicine, those things that were part of sci-fi projection now are really coming to pass. A bionic eyeball. That's right. And I've got a picture of one in front of me, and it is phenomenal what they are able to do. And they say the bionic eyeball might look like it's been plucked from the skull of a movie android. But really, for people that might have retinal disease and age-related macular degeneration, the two major causes of blindness, this particular bionic eyeball at this time could be absolutely awesome for them. Now, what it is, and it really looks real, it is a tiny camera attached to a pair of glasses that's worn by the individual, and it will gather images much like a real eye will, and then it transmits them wirelessly to a titanium-encased microchip on the eyeball itself. Now, the chip is stimulating retinal nerve cells, which will send pictures along the optic nerve to the brain. Now, this implant at this time will not restore full vision. However, they are working towards the goal of providing enough vision so that a person could walk down a familiar street without having to use a cane or a guide dog. And they're hoping to have this out in 3 years. Well, in 3 years, they may even go further than that. But this is a project that was co-invented by John Wyatt, who is an engineer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And remember the show Bionic Woman and the Bionic Man? Well, that was done so many years ago, and that just seemed so far-fetched, but it really isn't. The more we are able to recognize the way the body works, the nervous system, etc., there is going to be bionics that are going to be available that will enable people to do amazing things. And I think of the people, for example, in Seattle. They invented the Seattle foot that has just made amputees able to do things that they wouldn't have been able to do as comfortably before. So we've come a long, long way, and there are a lot of very dedicated people that know how important vision is, and wouldn't it be a phenomenal thing to be able to give sight to someone if they're losing it because of a particular situation like macular degeneration? I've known some very, very dear people in my life that when they were in their 70s and their 80s, this was affecting their lives totally. And to have something like this that would give them that opportunity to have vision and to be able to have a life where it wouldn't be without sight. It's just absolutely incredible. So we're going to be hearing more things about that, I think, as time goes on. And then I got some information regarding dental work where they're not going to have to drill. Yes, wouldn't that be exciting? You go into your dentist, he finds a cavity, you get it taken care of, no drilling, none of that stuff that goes on. It just drives you up a wall. The tonality and the sound, I think, is worse than the actual drilling itself. It really does affect you. But they are finding that there is a particular liquid resin that they can inject into the tooth, and when it goes into what they call the inner lattice of decay, it works in there, and it fits and takes care of things more efficiently than the traditional silver fillings or, you know, the composite ceramic fillings, what they do. Now, what it does, it solidifies and stops the cavity from progressing. They don't need to use anesthetic, and you don't have to use any drilling. There's a John Rao, a dentist in Jonesboro, Arkansas, that has been working with this product for more than a year. Wahoo! Wouldn't that be terrific? I'm ready. I know of a lot of people that would like that. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away. Don't forget you can give me a call at 888-815-9756. When we come back, I'll be telling you about a UFO. So don't go away.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Enter the magical world of God's Kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. I wanted to share a UFO story, and maybe you've heard about it if you're one of these people that enjoys studying the history of UFOs. And, of course, we've got more reports of those that have been happening than ever before in history. By the way, if you want to give me a call, 888-815-9756 is the number. Now, this happened in 1980 on December the 27th. There was a U.S. Army officer, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt. He was taken out very quickly from an awards dinner at the Royal Air Force Base in Woodbridge, Suffolk, England. Why? Because a UFO had been reported in the Rittlesham Forest. This was the second report of unusual activity in 3 days. So he immediately, when he was given the information, ordered that lights were set up around the area. But once they were set up, the lights wouldn't work. So the communication radios, they tried those. They would not work either. Well, Holt and his team decided they were going to go into the woods, and they were examining the previous landing spot when they became aware that some nearby farm animals were becoming very excited. To their amazement, a glowing object appeared, zigzagging through the trees, and it then settled in a field that had a very thick, circular kind of a fog, and the sounds that were being emitted from that fog were fairly loud. The glowing yellow and red object then began to throw off sparks, and they said it began to melt, or appeared to be melting anyway, before it exploded into 5 separate white objects. Now, the interesting thing is that these white objects flew away, and they had green, red, and blue lights. And one of these saucers, as they called it, beamed down a laser-thin ray of light, apparently being operated, because they said it just wasn't helter-skelter. It seemed like it was being controlled, like somebody was thinking about what they were doing. And this light began to do a grid search through the forest of Rendlesham. And then another of the objects zipped past the broken lights. Remember the ones that were not working? Well, every time it went over them, the lights turned on. They worked. Now, apparently, according to records that were kept 2 days earlier, John Burroughs and James Peniston were investigating a UFO report in this same forest. And they noted that during their investigation, there was a lot of static electricity in the air. As they were noticing that, they also spotted a triangular metallic object that had a pulsing red light. It was on the top of it, and also there were blue lights below it. And the forest was filled with glow of these. And they later said that when they started to approach this activity, there was a sense of slowness, like time itself was an effort. It was very difficult for them to walk and to move. They did notice that there were some symbols that were etched on the exterior of the object, and Hensington got close enough where he could touch them. When he did, the object became very, very bright and then flew away, not making a sound. And the very next day, three depressions were found in the frozen ground where this UFO had landed. Fascinating stories. Absolutely fascinating stories. And again, if you have a unique story of your own that you would like to share with me, I'm putting together a book. I want to collect 100 stories to submit to a publishing house, and your story can be included in the collection. So send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at DelphiInternational.com. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat, 888-815-9756. Animals have such a phenomenal impact on our lives, and I am consistently amazed at how they interact with each other. And you'll see programs on the station that carries Animal Planet, whatever that may be in your area, and you'll hear stories about kittens and parrots and dogs and, you know, ferrets and just all kinds of things. You go, wow, this is really unusual. Well, there is a story that I came across about a chimpanzee that has become a mother to Siberian tigers. And she is 4 years old. She lives at the Institute of the Greatly Endangered and Rare Species in South Carolina, and they primarily work towards saving the tigers. And she has become a surrogate mom to two tigers, Mitra and Shiva. And there was a hurricane that separated the cubs and their white tiger cubs, like Siegfried and Roy had. These are white tiger cubs. They were separated from their birth mother, and they were given, the tiny babies, the tiny cubs, were given with a human caretaker, or human caregiver, I should say, China York, who decided, then Ajana is the name of the chimpanzee, and the chimpanzee just took to these little baby tigers, and I've got a photo of her in front of me just cradling this baby, and she would sleep with them, and she even would hand-feed them bottles of milk. This is fascinating, I think. We don't often realize the empathy that can occur within animals. Of course, we human beings are animals, so why wouldn't other animals have something like this? But I've got stories in front of me regarding an elephant and a dog. I happened to see a program about that one not too long ago. And then a dog and an orangutan and, you know, wolves and then giraffes and an ostrich. There's just so many wonderful stories out there. And I think it should make us feel good because it gives a positive picture. We're deluged every day with so much of what is not working. I think if we can put our focus into what is working, and if something isn't coming about the way that we would like it, ask ourselves, how can we make a difference? What can we do differently? That is an important thing. We've got a fabulous weekend ahead of you. Happy Mother's Day to all of you ladies out there. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. The giving of life is a very special gift, being one that is a good example and is going to be able to share your love and your light with those that need it. That is also very, very special. God bless. Have a fabulous weekend. We'll be right back here on Monday, same time, same place. This is Donna Sebo. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.